In the years right before Jerusalem's fall, there was, as Josephus seems to indicate, an interest among some about what Judaism teaches, not only among those who actually converted to the Jewish faith, but even among those that were still part of pagan society, but who nevertheless felt, somehow, the allure of Jerusalem itself. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, Episode 82, The Mysterious Jewish Affinity of Nero's Wife. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Nero is without question one of the most infamous of emperors in Roman history, and among Roman writers, he is matched by the reputation of his second wife, Poppaea Sabina. Later historians of Rome associate her with the deaths of Nero's mother and his first wife, as well as that of others, and she is a villain in many stories about the period, including, as many point out, the novel and eventually wildly successful 1954 film, Quo Vadis. But as writers about Rome and the Jews note, there is a striking exception to the wholly negative portrayal of Poppaea in the writings of a Jew who himself had gotten to know Nero's wife. And that is a man who has come up in this podcast again and again, Josephus. Josephus does not deny the accusations against her, but does signify that she had some sort of important sympathy, not only for Jews in general, but perhaps also for Jerusalem. And this in turn might reveal something striking about the place of Jerusalem within the Roman world right before the sacred city fell. Following the death of King Agrippa I of Jerusalem, the Herodian line continued with the king's son, Agrippa II. But given the relative youth of the young prince, the emperor Claudius chose to send in a procurator who was truly in charge of the city. Claudius, meanwhile, himself died, apparently poisoned by his wife Agrippina, and was succeeded by Nero in the year 54. Then in the early 60s CE, a great controversy broke out in Jerusalem, brought about by the fact that Agrippa II decided to expand his palace so that he looked out on the priestly performance of the sacrifices. Josephus writes, quote, "About the same time, King Agrippa built himself a very large dining room in the royal palace at Jerusalem, near to the portico. Now this palace had been erected of old by the children of Asmoneus, and was situate upon an elevation, and afforded a most delightful prospect to those that had a mind to take a view of the city, which prospect was desired by the king. And there he could lie down and eat, and thence observe what was done in the temple. Which thing, when the chief men of Jerusalem saw, they were very much displeased at it, for it was not agreeable to the institutions of our country or law that what was done in the temple should be viewed by others, especially what belonged to the sacrifices. They therefore erected a wall upon the uppermost building, which belonged to the inner court of the temple, towards the west, which wall, when it was built, did not only intercept the prospect of the dining room in the palace, but also of the western cloisters that belonged to the outer court of the temple also, where it was that the Romans kept guards for the temple at the festivals." End quote. Thus, a wall was built in the temple complex, blocking Agrippa's view from his palace, as well as, perhaps unintentionally, blocking off Roman soldiers from the temple. At this, Agrippa and the Roman procurator sought to have the wall torn down. And given all that we have read about Agrippa I, we can understand that the son was not like his father when it came to reverence for the temple. The priests in Jerusalem, the Kohanim, accordingly sent a delegation to Nero in order to plead for the revocation of all the procurator sought to do. This request, Josephus writes, was granted, and we are given an intriguing explanation for why it was granted. Quote, "When Nero had heard what they had to say, he not only forgave them what they had already done, but also gave them leave to let the wall they had built stand. This was granted them in order to gratify Poppaea, Nero's wife, who was a religious woman and had requested these favors of Nero." End quote. So Josephus writes, a religious woman. What precisely does that mean? Josephus does not say, but what in the very least it connotes is a certain reverence, either for the Jewish faith or for the state of the temple in Jerusalem. That is interesting enough, but then, some 2 years later, Rome was visited by a young Jew of a priestly family, Yosef ben Matityahu, or Flavius Josephus himself. A member of one of the 24 priestly families that served in the temple, Josephus was sent at the age of 26 to Rome to plead on behalf of some of his fellow Kohanim, his fellow priests, who had been imprisoned by the Roman procurator. And during a shipwreck, he finally arrived at the epicenter of the empire. In his book, Jerusalem's Traitor, Desmond Seward conjures for us what that first visit must have been like for the young Kohen. Quote, "However beautiful and imposing Jerusalem may have been, it cannot have compared with the glittering megalopolis that Josephus found when he arrived. In today's terms, it was a combination of Washington, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, with London, Paris, and every other European capital thrown in, since it was not just the center of the Roman Empire, but the political, economic, and cultural center of the civilized world. There was something monstrous about the scale of this vast urban conglomeration, which a Jew might be forgiven for comparing to Babylon of unhappy memory. Undeniably, it was magnificent, full of huge and wonderful buildings, the capital, the forum, the pantheon, and the Temple of Mars being only the best known. Their walls were covered in marble, their roofs in gilded tiles, while everywhere there were statues of marble, bronze, or even gold. Yet at the same time, the city was overcrowded and dirty, a rabbit warren of filthy lanes lying behind these marvels, end quote. As Seward also notes, most importantly for our subject, what Josephus would have found in Rome was fellow Jews. Jews that not only would have allowed him access into the imperial court, but would also perhaps have illustrated to him the interest in Judaism and its doctrines and belief in the larger world. Seward adds, quote, Josephus found plenty of his own people in Rome. 50 years before, the geographer Strabo had complained that Jews were taking over every city in the world. In Josephus' own words, there is not a single city, whether Greek or barbarian, not a single nation, which our custom of doing no work on the seventh day has not reached, where our fasts, lamplighting, and food rituals go unobserved. Rome had become a center of the diaspora, the Jewish expatriate communities, with a Hebrew population numbering tens of thousands, who inhabited districts all over the city, each group living near a synagogue and with their own extensive cemeteries. End quote. It was a Jew that gained Josephus entree to the court of the emperor. And Josephus' own small recollection of this matter tells us so much. Josephus writes, I became acquainted with Aliturius, an actor of plays, and much beloved by Nero, but a Jew by birth, and through his interest became known to Poppaea, Caesar's wife, and took care as soon as possible to entreat her to procure that the priest might be set at liberty. And when, besides this favor, I had obtained many presents from Poppaea, I returned home again. End quote. Every sentence in this passage of Josephus tells us something. We learn of a Jew who had become a celebrated playwright in Rome, who was himself not only celebrated by the emperor, but also looked upon fondly by the empress, perhaps because of his Jewishness. This at least indicates the success that certain Jews had found within Rome. On its own, it says nothing about the way Romans saw Judaism, but we are also informed that the empress in turn not only helped ensure the release of the Kohanim, but also bestowed gifts upon this young Jew, Josephus, who himself at this point surely did not know how intertwined his own story would be with that of Rome. And upon returning to Jerusalem at its most beautiful state, Josephus also surely did not know then that only a few years after that, he would be watching the treasures of the sacred city paraded through the Roman Forum. And while the Empress of Rome may have been a powerful ally for Jerusalem, she also, as historians noted, inspired the appointment of a procurator whose own crackdown on the city would inspire the revolt. And she herself did not live long, dying of injuries after being brutally kicked by her husband. But there may be a memento from the moment of the meeting between this young priest from Jerusalem and this empress that was interested in Jews. For as Seward further writes, quote, if a fine first century portrait bust really is that of Josephus, then it may well have been commissioned by Poppaea, which indicates a certain affection on her part, end quote. We have then, ladies and gentlemen, two interesting episodes in which the wife of the Caesar intervened on behalf of the Jews of Jerusalem, and, even more interestingly, where she was reported to have a religious affinity for, or at least interest in, the faith of Jerusalem. I've seen various theories for why this might have been, including, I believe, the suggestion that the empress had Jewish servants in her palace, or that she was part of a group known as God-fearers, who were not converts to Judaism, but nevertheless interested in the Jewish faith. To the notion that the empress was truly attracted to the vision of Judaism in the fullness of its moral and spiritual worldview, scholars note in response that anyone with a reputation for ruthlessness akin to Poppaea could never have embraced a series of doctrines approximating that of Judaism. Yet, however we choose to interpret Poppaea's own actions, it seems that this story illustrates something striking about Judaism's place in the world at this point. In descriptions of the clash between the empire and Judea, one will often see references to strong anti-Judaic feelings on the part of Rome. And this is certainly a phenomenon that will play a strong role in Jewish history. For as we will see, the Rome of Vespasian and Titus will proclaim the defeat of Judaism everywhere. But in the Roman world, in the years right before Jerusalem's fall, there was, as Josephus seems to indicate, an interest among some about what Judaism teaches, not only among those who actually converted to the Jewish faith, but even among those that were still part of pagan society, but who nevertheless felt, somehow, the allure of Jerusalem itself. If this is the case, then it is worth pondering what might have happened had Jerusalem not fell, had Jewish unity happened rather than the fratricidal fracturing that ensured defeat at the hands of the Romans. What if the Jewish city had stood? Would it have become a monotheistic beacon in a Roman pagan world? And that, in turn, should inspire Jews to ponder our own time, for we live in a world where aspects of contemporary culture are not only secular, but even in certain ways pagan. And yet, it is also true in our own age that Jewish Jerusalem stands as a beacon of faith to so many. We are therefore inspired to ponder what can be accomplished on behalf of the biblical worldview. History has so much to teach us, and looking back and looking forward, we cannot help but wonder what God has in mind for the Jews in our time and for the beacon that is Jerusalem in the age in which we live. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.